Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and today is a special broadcast in memory of Fred Ridholm. I interviewed Fred for another show I did a few years ago, and at that moment in time, Fred was struggling with cancer. Fred Ridholm was one of those people you probably have never heard of, but he was an icon in his field. And his field was ancient America. He believed and was convinced that ancient America was far different from anything we could possibly have imagined. Rather than being a distinct continent which nobody cared about and which had no contact with the old world as we know it, he became convinced by walking around his own neighborhood that that was definitely not the case. Fred was an inhabitant of the Northern Lakes, and when he, as he recounts at the beginning of the interview, as a young boy was on Isle Royale, he became confronted with the vast amounts of copper which had there been mined in the ancient past. And when he looked at that, he began to question why. He began to ask who had done this and what was the origins of the people who had done so. And he realized that none of this could have been done by locals. He realized that the people who had been responsible for this had come from elsewhere. He realized that the people who had come here in a very ancient past, and he knew that those people had been using boats. Fred became convinced that those people came from Europe. And together we came up with a very simple tagline which said, in America there is an overflow of copper being mined in about 2000 BC, and nowhere in the old world was this used. At the same time, we have the Bronze Age, which relied on copper and tin to create bronze. And nowhere in the old world, in Europe, is there sufficient amount of mines, which have been identified as being mined at that time, for the vast amount of quantities of copper which have been used. By coupling these two probabilities together, we came upon the theory that perhaps there was indeed transoceanic contact in those days. And when you delve deeper, you will find that places like the Orkneys, on just off the north tip of Scotland, has a very dramatic megalithic civilization. Here we are led to believe as an outpost of Europe, with just a few hundred people living on this island. Yet, they were able to build massive amounts of megalithic monuments, which stand as testimony to their acumen to this very day. And guess what? Once America was discovered by Columbus, and there was an active trade between specifically the region where Fred became interested in, we also began to use the Orkneys once again as a port to go to America and back. Yet when you look at everybody who has been talking about ancient America, you will not find the name of Fred listed prominently. Most of his books were self-published. He wrote a few articles. He made an extensive list of people who he knew. And at the end of his life, he was rewarded by ancient American and like organizations for the contributions to the field he had done. Fred was a pioneer. Fred was one of those people who you did not see. He was working in the background. He was researching, and he had opinions which were always based on scientific fact. He knew that there were lots of charlatans about, and when he found out about them, he not necessarily exposed them, but made sure that they would not get a proper airing. At the same time, he kept promoting his belief and his conviction that there was indeed ancient contact between two continents in the past. Fred was all about a different vision of who we were, and it was a very important vision to have. It was something which he cherished and which he worked for a number of years. He was a true spirit revolutionary, and without further ado, as they say, this is an interview which I recorded in January of 2009 with the man himself, Fred Ridholm. Fred, it's an honor to have you here. You are one of the true icons, one of the living legends of ancient history. You have been mapping for years, for decades, the history of the Great Lakes region, specifically Michigan states and surrounding areas. What got you involved?
It was back in 1937 when I was with the Boy Scouts. I was just a young boy, and I went to Isle Royale and saw all those copper mines over there, all those pits. Nobody knew much about them then except that they were copper mines. They called them copper mines, and I didn't even know there was copper around here at that time. But the fact that they said there were thousands and thousands of them, and I went everywhere we found them, and there was copper all over, too. I asked what they did with that copper, and they said they made arrowheads. Well, I couldn't believe that there would be that many pits. They arrived at about 5,000 pits, but there's probably 5,000 just around McCargo's Cove by itself. And there's many, many have been destroyed on the mainland. There must have been many more, maybe 20 or 30,000 on the mainland. And they go clean down into Wisconsin, over to Minnesota. They go to Michipicoten Island, and they go on the north shore of Lake Superior. They're all over. And all we ever found, anyone has ever found, was axe heads and arrowheads. And I had never seen a copper arrowhead at that time. But I got in with a Mr. Gannon, who was working with a Dr. Roy Dwyer from Michigan Tech University, and they had been trying to find out who these people were, and of course everybody said they were Indians. But there's no way that this could be the end of a copper trade with just these arrowheads. When at the same time, over there in Europe, they were using huge amounts of copper. Huge amounts. They put rams on ships that weighed half a ton. And they lined the bottoms of ships. And they made statues and pottery and vases and chariots. The armies with bronze, 90% copper, were supposed to have been 48 pounds of armor on every soldier. Some of those armies were 200,000 strong. They made the Colossus of Rhodes, as big as the Statue of Liberty, out of bronze, 90% copper. And they didn't have that kind of copper over there. They had many sources of it, but not all of it was found in ancient times, and it was low-grade copper ore. And here our copper was 99% pure, the purest copper in the world, and you didn't have to mine it. It was set free. It was just laying on the ground. So that's what got me curious, and I have been working on that ever since.
Just to insert some facts here, there's about 10 to 50 million pounds of copper, which is assumed or known to have mined from the Great Lakes area. That's an enormous amount of copper.
And it just goes to the people that you listen to. They don't know how much went out of here, because most of this copper was in huge chunks that were right on the surface. And they were washed clear, and they took them away. They didn't find any on the surface until later. And when they did find them, they dug them out of the ground, and they had to free them from the rock, and then they had timbers under them. They were raising them up to take them away.
And some sites, as you're pointing out, still seem to have that material inside, where for some reason they started to remove a copper deposit, but never really did it. And so it's almost as if at one point in time the workers literally left and never came back.
Right. And for 100 years they were saying, here, where did all the copper go? And for 100 years over in the Mediterranean they were saying, where did all the copper come from? But nobody could conceive of people crossing the oceans. They figured those oceans were barriers. But they were highways, and in ancient times, there were people traveling all over the world by water. We're just now beginning to realize that.
Have you, or has anybody, found any evidence whatsoever in that area which might suggest or which shows that there was this transoceanic contact?
Well, yes, there's been, at first it was always thought to be Indians, but now, about the same time that John Wesley Powell was the head of the Smithsonian, he threw out everything saying that it was, that anybody came here before Columbus. But at that same time, in the 1880s and 90s, there were many things that were found. And in our area here, in Minnesota, on the west end of Lake Superior, they found the Kensington Stone, which has been under great controversy. And in our area here, we found the, what we call the Magruder's Gods, which we think the Kensington Stone was Viking. We think the Magruder's Gods were Cypriot Minoan. Then there were the Soper tablets, which were in Lower Michigan. And then we found an Irish, well, an old Celtic stone, the prayer stone, in the Escanaba River. All of those were found in this area. It seems like there's many things that are Minoan, but they haven't been proved. They're bronze, and they their axe heads or their pots or so forth. Something, and those are probably the oldest. And then there's Phoenician things, and then there's Celtic things, and then there's Viking things, but they've all been ignored or declared fraud. But now with a new look at things, maybe some of them aren't, and they should all have another look.
Yes, and when we're talking about Minoans, to some extent, Phoenicians, and the link between Minoans, Phoenicians, and specifically the sea people, they've got one thing in common, which is that they were all seafaring nations. And obviously the Vikings, everybody knows that the Vikings went south to England, Scotland, and Europe, but the question is whether they might not have gone westward and just arrived
in these
territories.
But there was the Old Norse, too, and the Old Irish that preceded the Viking period. But they were Old Norse. There's much evidence of those kind of people here, the Celtic people that were, you know, they were kind of mixed up, those northerners, the British Isles and the Scandinavian countries. Then the Irish monks, there's evidence of them up and down the east coast here. And on Iceland and on Newfoundland. But they were always misinterpreted because nobody came here before Columbus. And that's why we have to take a new look at everything.
One of the things which I think the Great Lakes area shares with Europe is also the presence of dolmen and various other megalithic remains. Have you looked into whether there is a certain correspondence between the megaliths of the Great Lakes and Europe?
Well, they've always said that the ones here were glacial erratics, and the ones over there were from the megalithic societies, but they're the same thing. And there are many of them here. They're on certain places here. They're on mountaintops. I believe that they're all, practically all megaliths from European people. And there is some in Canada that have three stones in each leg. And those are not glacial erratics. And there's also a trilithon up there. Those are people from Europe that were here, I'm sure. You have to put all the things together to say that they are, you know. It's hard to prove one thing, but when you get a whole bunch of things that all follow that pattern, it seems that they can't be glacial.
Around the copper mines themselves, have there been any other evidence of the people who lived there? Is it known whether they were there all year round? Have they found some of their homes? What have they found?
The domiciles or the pottery is all of a later date. And there isn't anything from the early people. There doesn't seem to be anything. But I believe that they brought their ships right up to the shore. And they lived on their ships. Those people were sea people. And they were used to living on their ships. and they cooked on their ships. They didn't need any roads or any paths or anything. They brought the copper from the land onto their ships. That has always been a mystery. Why isn't there evidence of towns or pathways or graves? And I think they were just living off their ships. They came here and they left. They would come back again at another year in the summer.
I mean, it's definitely a rough climate, I believe, to survive there during the winter.
Our winters would have been terrible for them here. By coming early in the year, or I mean, arriving early in the year and then leaving early in the fall, they could, you know, have 2-3 months of digging. And I think that they were cooperating with the local people here, too, that were probably getting copper ready for them to take away. And another thing, we have an awful lot of stone axes that are polished. Now, most of the points and axes here are, you know, they're made from splitting hard rock. But these polished stones are just like the ones in Europe. I don't see anybody polishing any here. They're always trying to mimic those points that are here. But I think that they were in the Bronze Age or the Copper Age over there, so they brought stone tools here to trade, to give for people to work with here. Because we find those same things. I found the same shaped stone axes and so forth in England and in France that we find here. Same thing.
You're not the first one to have highlighted this possibility of when people from Bronze Age Europe might have come to America. And one of them is Professor Jim Bailey, who has been actually putting that date back to about 5,000 BC. Do you subscribe to that dating, or do you think it's...
Oh, yes. I'm sure that they noticed those big chunks of copper on islands here. They must have. Anyone who came here would have seen them. After Mr. Dreyer, or Dr. Dreyer and Joe Gannon died, I thought I was the only one in the world that thought that way. But suddenly, I got in contact with Barry Fell, and he put me in touch with Jim Bailey, and I found there were people all over the world that believed that and had been studying it for years. It gave me a lot of impetus to look further, because when you got an idea of your own, you think it could be all wrong, you know. But I found people on both sides of the Atlantic and all over the United States. There were groups that had the same idea, that people had been coming here for years and years.
Just reading in your book about some of the conclusions Professor Bailey reached, one of them was that the only place in the world where native copper existed in economic quantities was around Lake Superior, and you add with a little bit at Coracora in Bolivia, but also that the oldest and most sacred city of Suma, Eridu, which according to some is actually where the name Earth originates from, was the Sumerian name for copper. So copper really is at the base of a lot of ancient civilizations. And again, Lake Superior seems to be the only place where you can get it in the amounts you can get it.
What's there's nowhere else in the world that has anywhere near the amount of it that's in the Lake Superior region. And here it's the purest, 99%+ pure, and it's broken free. You don't have to dig it out of the matrix. A lot of it was just sitting right on the ground, sitting there, and that's what people have trouble realizing that. Our organization is trying to buy what we believe to be the largest piece of float copper, and when I say float copper, I meant it was floated with the glacier. It was moved from its original spot. The largest piece of float copper in existence, because wherever I go and I start talking about those big pieces of copper, they think I'm exaggerating. But we've got one that weighs 50 ton now The largest that I've ever heard of was 412 ton. We've got this 50, and I think that might have been a piece of drift found in the earth. But this one is actually flattened out and in the glacial till, and it's right where it was found, and it weighs 50 ton, and we're trying to buy that to show people the size, and there's many, many of them that are 5 and 10 and 15 and 20 tons around. But this one is the largest one, and I'd like to keep it if we can to show people. And then it makes them think a little bit. What, all this copper here? And it's been estimated that 90% of it is still here. They haven't only been mining here for 8,000 years, and they've only removed 10% of it. Mm-hmm. So it's in huge layers underneath Lake Superior and around the Lake Superior here.
In your book, you also mention how in a Smithsonian brochure, large pieces of copper were photographed and then used in that brochure, which appeared in the 1970s. And you're pointing out that a lot of this copper has just disappeared. Nobody seems to know where it's gone to.
Yes. That Smithsonian brochure, which I picked up in 1973, said they no longer find these big pieces of copper. They've probably found 50 bigger than that since then. But the real scientists ignore this copper question, and they don't know about it. They can't conceive of it. And I've run into it over and over again. And other places in our own country, they don't know about the copper country up here. They say, we didn't even know there was copper up there. And here it's world famous. But it just seems to be unknown. They know more about it in Europe than we do in America here.
When you look at all of these copper mines and where they are situated, what would you say is like the biggest concentration of copper? Where, if I were to say, I've got one day to come over to your area and show me those mines, what would you show me?
Well, the Keweenaw Peninsula is covered with them, but the modern mining has ruined a lot of them. But Isle Royale, it hasn't been destroyed in modern, but the modern miners were there too. But that one place around McCargo's Cove was supposed to be mined three times. It was mined ancient times. It was mined by the British in the 1700s, and it was mined by the Americans in the 1800s. And there's still copper around there, right where they were mining. They're all mining in the same place. But there are other areas that are loaded with copper, but they're hard to get to now because they follow those veins down 2 miles, and it's becomes real expensive, you know.
Have you found any megalithic remains around those sites, or is it actually a very industrial area? Was it just like mining?
There have been some Celtic chambers with the lintel across the top that have been reported to me, but I can't find them. 6 of them have been reported to me. Mm-hmm. But then there are many dolmens that were ignored because people didn't know what they were. And there's some of those up in the copper country. There's one right here in Marquette County on the top of a mountain. And there's one on the top of a mountain in Canada, and one on the top of a mountain in Wisconsin, and then there's another one in Minnesota that's right next to a canoe route. So those dolmens are around Lake Superior, and I think they go back to those megalithic people.
If in your book you include a drawing taken from one of the Smithsonian publications, and it clearly shows, I think, the drawing itself, that rock definitely didn't get on the smaller rocks underneath by accident. Somebody put that there.
Yes, but they thought that had to be a glacial. And that was in the Smithsonian publications back in the 50s. And the people then were saying that they looked like the ones in Europe. But then the authorities here said, no, these are a glacial here. It was all just ignored.
You've been exposed to this non-belief by establishment archaeologists for several decades. Have you come up with an explanation as to why they're doing it? Is it just that they don't want to change the paradigm, or is there something else to it?
Well, it's very difficult for those people who have been through college and learned this paradigm and been teaching it for years. The head of the history department at our university here in town was here the other day. My book has been out for over a year, and he hasn't looked at it even. But I gave him one, and he wrote me a letter, and he said he's going to read it now. I think it may change his mind. And I said, I'm not trying to change your mind, but I want you to know there's another side of the story. There's another explanation, which in my way of thinking answers all the questions. And their explanation doesn't answer all the questions. It ends up with everything is a fraud, everything has been faked, everything has been planted. I don't believe people did all that. There may be some fakes out there, but if they had real scientific examinations of all this stuff, they're going to find that many of it could be real and not, they're authentic, you know, they aren't fake.
With Lake Superior, the Great Lake area, the possibility that there is trade and especially copper going to Europe, would we have to see that area as being singled off, as in isolation from the rest of America? Or do you think that there was also contact, or even more than just contact, with the mound builders?
Oh, yes, I'm sure there was contact. And I think the mound builders were up this way. And for years, I was always told there aren't any mounds in Upper Michigan. But there are mounds here. There's lots of them. And we're just realizing what they are here. There's at least 20 that I know of. And the idea that this was isolated, it had four different routes by water into these lakes, because these lakes are, Lake Superior, 600 feet above sea level, and it flows in four different directions. So people could get to it from the Pacific in the northwest. They could get to it from the Atlantic, from the Gulf of Mexico on the Mississippi, and from the Atlantic on the St. Lawrence River. The easiest route would have been through Hudson Bay, and they would only go upstream for one little river on the Nipigon River to get into Lake Superior. And then it was all downstream from Lake Superior to the Gulf of Mexico. And that would have been a three-year trip. And it has been suggested that there's some ancient lead mines in Iowa. It's possible that those ships came in from the north, picked up their copper in Lake Superior, went on down to Iowa and picked up their lead, and went down the Mississippi and were home. A three-year trip. That trade went on for so many thousands of years, at least 3,000 years, and much more than that possible. There must have been many groups that came here, and they used all of the routes, I'm sure. We've only been here 150 years, and we've mined out anything that we could get a hold of, but imagine a 3,000-year spread. What went on in that amount of time?
Earlier I was saying that the people who were mining some of those mines definitely left in mid-work and never seemed to have come back. When you look at the entire copper mine landscape, were some of the mined to where it became just too hard to mine certain mines further, or actually were most mines pretty much still able to continue to give copper at a very easy pace?
Yeah, I think there was both. I think the Minoans were the first miners. Somebody told me that Minoan meant miners, And another interesting word is Manang, which is, or it's a Norse word, but it's the Indian name for Isle Royal. And Manang means the place of the mines in Old Norse. And Manang Mountain is the mountain right next to that place where all that copper was done. But I believe that the Minoans were the earliest ones, and when that Santorini volcano exploded, which is only about 60 miles from Crete, and they were covered with a tsunami and 4 or 5 feet of ash, and that was the end of the Minoans as far as sea trading, and that's when the Phoenicians took over. But I think the Minoans were the ones that were taking those big pieces and doing a lot of that early mining. And that's why it ended right there, and they never came back.
Now, earlier you already hinted at some of the more controversial aspects, the objects which some people have labeled fakes. Amongst them, what I find the most intriguing are the Michigan tablets, or sometimes known as the Soper tablets as well. Could you tell a bit more about them?
Well, the Michigan tablets were found between the Civil War, which was about 1865, up until about 1916. They were found in mounds in 23 or 27 counties in lower Michigan, and a few northern counties of Ohio and Indiana and Illinois. But those were strange things, and they were declared fake and all that, and they think that Mr. Soper was making them. And he may have faked some, but there's too many of them. There may have been 30,000 pieces. And there's about 5 collections around the country. The largest one was 3,000 pieces that were sent out to Salt Lake City. And we just received them back in Michigan. But there were, when I saw them in Salt Lake City, there were about 1,570 pieces from 3,000 that were sent. But they were in barrels, and a lot of them got broken. Then they went to down here in Lansing, and there's 760 pieces. Every time they get moved, they disappear. And that's supposed to be the largest collection. There's another collection that David Deal has out in California. There's one on the East Coast, and there's some smaller ones in Detroit. But we'd like to get those all together and just let the people see them, because every time they talk about them, they say these are fraudulent and these were all made by so-and-so. But now David Deal believes those were Coptic Christians, and he can translate some of the writing on there. They're one that very controversial, but they need study by the right people. And obviously there probably are some fake pieces in there, but that doesn't mean they all are.
I mean, at the time of the discovery, one Professor Starr of the University of Chicago, he was actually there, or he was actually digging up two mounds and found some of these tablets in there. And also, I believe some of those tablets have a strong connection with copper. So it all kind of seems to tie in together. When I look at the Michigan copper tablets, their inscriptions, their style, reminds me quite a bit of the Burroughs Cave artifacts, which Harry Hubbard spoke about before. You've been involved with the Burroughs Cave as well. Have you felt that the Burroughs Cave fits a larger framework, or do you think that the Burroughs Cave is like a standalone discovery?
No, I think there are some connections that the mystic symbol, those three marks, have been found in Burroughs Cave and have been found on all of the pieces of the Soper tablets. And they're in the same area, roughly, you know, that Wabash River comes right out of Toledo, Ohio, which is on the Great Lakes, and there's been evidence of those sulfur tablets all over that lower part of Michigan. I think that Burroughs, Russell, and myself are the only two people I know of now are still alive that has handled and seen over 8,000 pieces from Burroughs Cave. While 98% of the professionals either won't talk about it or they say it's all a big fraud, I'm one that has to hold that open, because I can't conceive anybody today that knows enough to make all those things. There's no mistakes on any of them. There's lots of different writings. There's stuff that connects those to King Juba, Cleopatra Selene, and her brother, Alexander Helios. There's a book out now by Frank Joseph who explains the historical background possible that fits that perfect, that those people came here. It definitely connects them to those deities that go all the way from Ptolemies and Alexander the Great, and through the nine Cleopatras, right down to Cleopatra Selene. Even though they didn't like each other, they still treated those bodies like they were deities. And I believe that some of those in the cave, if they ever get in there, will prove to possibly be Cleopatra Selene or Alexander Helios or the last Ptolemy, because I think that story seems to fit. But, of course, we can't make any positive statements until they get in the cave. And they're right on the verge of it now, but nobody's been in it yet except Russell.
Going down the list of controversial artifacts, you mentioned the Makrua gods, which you said were more than likely the script on them, were probably Cypriot Minoan. Again, so we're back to that Minoan connection there. They were discovered in Michigan as well, as I believe at the end of the 19th century. They then seem to have moved to the Smithsonian Institute.
The Smithsonian, long ago, had some very, very crude leaders, three in a row. They marched to their own drum, and they threw out huge amounts of stuff if it didn't fit their own paradigm. And then the second one did the same thing. And the third one was John Wesley Powell, who almost did the same thing. He threw out a lot of stuff, too, that he said was fake. Huge amounts. Papers that were turned in there were destroyed, or because they told about people that were here before Columbus, and he just would not believe that. And now they're still going along with the same ideas. And those scientists are just breaking away. One or two of them are just discovering things that they could hardly believe, that the rest of the world has been believing all the time. And those people are in their own little bailiwick, and they work on certain subjects, but they don't want to get out on the fringe, you know. I think that it's all beginning to bust down a little bit now, but just beginning. Mm-hmm. And the one big item now is that we heard for years that the Indians came from the west, and it's obvious that they came from every direction. And that the Clovis Point were the first people here, and now they found the Solutrean people in Spain had a forerunner of that point, and that fits right in with Barry Fell's ideas that some of them came right from Spain, and the Bell Beaker people and all those came from down there, and then there was another group of Celtic people that came from Ireland and the British Isles. Those old ideas are beginning to break down a little bit, but just by one or two scientists. And this is the first time I've seen it. So I think that in time and now they've discovered older cities than they knew existed down there in Peru and Mexico. And they're finding bones that go back pre-glacial. And things are kind of in the hub, mixed up now, because there's still people trying to hang on to the old ideas, and they're breaking out into the new ones. So we're in a kind of exciting time, and it'll probably take 10 or 20 years for it to shift. But I hope that they just start looking at some of this stuff that they've thrown out or that they call fake. And we're trying to get a museum where we will hold all the stuff that's questionable so it can be available for study.
Because when actually the McGrew got part of that collection was studied by Dr. Barry Fell, he actually came up with a decipherment of the writing on one of the panels and quite straightforwardly was able to translate it as a means of divination, an omen from birds, how to do omens from birds. Going down the list of controversial artifacts, and we're almost at the end of it, which is the Davenport Stone. Now, from what I understand, the Davenport Stone actually might show aspects of the Jade Festival, an Egyptian festival. Can you tell us some more about the Davenport Stone?
Well, there was the Davenport Stone was found on the bank of the Mississippi River in 1864 by a Reverend Gass. When I questioned those people at the museum there in Davenport, Iowa, they said that they thought that was planted by people from their museum to as a joke on this Reverend Gass. Well, they didn't even know about those ceremonies or that writing. That is a kind of a Rosetta Stone. It has three different, it has old hieroglyphics, and it has two other writings on it that Barry Fell was able to translate, and fakers can't make up that stuff. He's even compared it with some stuff that was found on the Iberian Peninsula. The same, it's not what you'd find in a scholarly work, but it's found on that plate, that Davenport Stone. That's another one that's very controversial and that needs fresh study.
And the last in my list is the Joel Keller Stone. Again, the same question. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Well, I was there the night that Joe Keller brought that in. Some high school boys found it. And it was in the Escanaba River, about 15 miles from where I live. That stone, the first head of the archaeology department at the University of Michigan told me it was caused by the sun. And the second one, some years later, said it was caused by salt crystals. But it looked like a writing of some kind. Joel thought it was a Norse, but obviously to me it wasn't Norse, it was straight lines. It wasn't until 25 years later that we sent it to Barry Fell, and it was Ogham Consane, the old type of Ogham. He claimed that it was a prayer stone made in the island of Iona, off the coast of Scotland, and we went there, and there were people that saved those stones, that they had prayer stones. Here that was in the Escanaba River here, and it said, "A prayer on my behalf, let me not drown on the waters." And that was a stone that they carried with them, and he claimed that the fishermen on those islands still carry prayer stones to sea with them. That one has never been looked at by any archaeologist. They ignore it. But to me, it's a real find, and I know all about that one.
Where is it at the moment?
it's lost. He took it to Florida with him, and he got divorced, and he went to Florida, and he had it in an old car down there, and he died. But we've got some real good pictures of it. But the stone is gone. It's like so many other things, they're gone. But this one had professional photographs taken of it, so we at least have those. And it was the photographs that Barry Fell was able to translate.
Mm-hmm. With so many things gone, with a history going back thousands of years to reconstruct, when do you think the paradigm will begin to shift, and what do you think it needs for it to shift?
Well, it's going to be difficult to rewrite all this stuff. And we have a man now in California. He's got a little committee together, and they're doing one of these PowerPoint things to give to the high school students in America, and he's sending them out free. And his name is Dr. Myron Payne. If we start getting the young people interested, they're the ones that are going to pick up and do these studies. I don't think the older people will. I think they're too far ingrained in their own thinking. But some of them will. I like to say that we're right on the brink of starting that movement now with Myron Payne's PowerPoint.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Fred. It's clear that people have been coming to America for much longer than we think, but it also means that the new world is becoming more and more the old world, and if anything, perhaps even the oldest world, younger than what we consider to be the old world. So I would like to thank you for years, decades of contribution, and thanks for talking to me. And keep up the good work.
Very good. Thank you. And you do the same.
Unfortunately, Fred passed away a few months later. You could probably hear at some point during the interview how he was struggling to keep it going, and even the timing of the interview itself had to be coordinated so that he was not in agony from the cancer which was eating him away. Fred was a guy who won major awards. He at one point was named Mr. Copper, and he also served as a 3-time mayor and city commissioner in Marquette. He was awarded the Distinguished Citizens Award from Northern Michigan University in 2002, and the Mining Museum gave him a special recommendation as well. Fred was one of those people who really didn't stand still whenever there was controversy or ridicule. When some people dared to not go, Fred just jumped in head first. Whenever he was confronted with stories of fake and ridicule and other denigrating material, he just wanted to see the facts. He was a true spirit revolutionary because he wanted to paint a picture of America according to reality and not according to dogma or human shortcomings. He believed and he supported the idea with very fundamental hard facts that America had been part of this world since 5000 BC, and that the scientific paradigm that somehow America was only discovered from roughly 1492 onwards simply could not stand up to this evidence which he had not only found but had verified across America. Fred is part of a small group of people who continue to do that, who have persisted in doing this despite the controversy which comes their way. Fred is somewhat different from the other people because, again, he has not got the notoriety. He didn't do this because he was a doctor. He didn't do this for any other reason except the fact that as a small child, he saw with his own very eyes how massive amounts of copper had been quarried, had been mined in an island, in a region which he loved and which he knew and every inch about. Every fiber of his being, every bone of his body knew that the truth was so different from what academics were saying. and it set him upon a lifelong quest to change that paradigm. He was one of those people who said, when he was confronted with my question as to when this paradigm would change, he said how some people are holding on to old ideas, yet some others are breaking into the new, and that it might take another 10 or 20 years before the shift would be able to happen. But he was firmly convinced that the shift was going to happen, either through means of one gigantic discovery, which is going to change everything, or through the means of a series of small discoveries, which is going to change everything. But he was one of those people who truly believed that the truth should be against the world. And the truth, as he points out in one clear example, is this. Across America, there are remains of mound builders. Mounds which are everywhere. Gigantic mounds. Various other megalithic remains, which scientists in America and elsewhere in the world are not focusing on. Only in recent decades have in some quarters some efforts begun to actually preserve these areas, protect them from land development and various other potential misuse. But he, Fred, was there. He had gone to these places. He had done the research. When he's confronted with the fact that at one point 30,000 artifacts are removed from these mounds, he finds it ridiculous that science can still uphold this story, that this is somehow all a fake, that people have done this simply to fake it or out of a joke. It simply cannot be. It's not logical, and furthermore, the evidence which he time and time again uncovered simply points out to the fact that it cannot be. Yet science still today wants to adhere to this accepted paradigm that America has never been visited before Columbus, and that people who lived there were just, well, you know, isolated from the rest of the world and had no idea about anything else in the world. Ancient America, from the way Fred Ridholm discovered this, is vastly more spectacular, it's vastly wider, it's vastly more beautiful, vastly more interesting. And so what Fred did was show us many things. He showed us a new America. He showed us how the new world really wasn't that new, but had always been part of the old world as such. He also showed us how, with zeal, bravery, effort, beauty of character and style, you are able to hack away at this paradigm and try to accumulate more and more evidence so that in the end, the paradigm will break. But at the same time, Fred was a beautiful man, a multifaceted man, one of those people who really is one of those who is a true spirit revolutionary. As I said, Fred wasn't famous. Fred wasn't known for anything much. He was published, mostly self-published. And to get material from him, go to the website which his family is still maintaining. The website is www.superiorheartland.com. That is superiorheartland.com. At one point in the interview, I ask him a question about the Burroughs Cave. For that information, you can visit two articles which I've written, one of them award-winning as well. And you can go to the spiritrevolution.com website to find more about what Fred was doing with copper and what Burroughs potentially has discovered in Illinois, which is a cave that, if proven to be authentic and if proven to be, you know, an effort whereby the world can really rally itself around one cause, so that really we will change this paradigm, just one of so many paradigms which need shifting, we will get a true understanding. Because what Fred was doing was a spirit revolution. I have said it time and time again. What he was doing was spectacular. And he has left us with a legacy, which I hope that in the 43 minutes of which my interview with him lasted, I have been able to share with you as well. This was another edition of The Spirit Revolution. On behalf of Kathleen McGowan, who couldn't be with us today, my name is Philip Coppens, and I wish you the best of weeks. I hope we have inspired you once again to keep etching away at that paradigm so that the Spirit Revolution can occur. We are thespiritrevolution.com, and until next time, as Kathleen would always say at this moment in time, the truth against the world.